Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast, raising awareness and inspiring action for personal and planetary health with your hosts, Ben and Emma.
Hello, everybody. My name is Ben Adelberg.
And I'm Emma Strutt.
And welcome to episode 28. Before we carry on, for those of you in Auckland, we're piloting our new seminar at a handful of libraries titled Lifestyle Changes for Personal and Planetary Health. And you can find all those details to those seminars on our refreshed website if you haven't been on there yet, which now also has a whole bunch of other resources, including our recommended reading list, as well as the links to the just released Working Group 1 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which we're going to continually refer to as the IPCC report. And as such, we thought it was high time we have a returning guest who holds the current all-time listening record for the Lentil Intervention. Emma?
Yeah, that's right. So we've got the return of our most popular guest to date, Dr. Mike Joy. Since we talked to him last year in Season 1, Episode 12, a lot has happened. So we thought it was about time we check in again for a bit of an update. For those who haven't listened to that episode, firstly, please do, because it was brilliant. But secondly, to introduce Mike to any new listeners, Mike is a freshwater ecologist and climate champion, currently working as a senior research fellow at the Institute of Governance and Policy Studies at Victoria Uni. We've got a lot to talk about today, so let's dive right in. Mike, thank you so much for joining us for round two.
Oh, no, thank you very much, Ben and Emma. Really nice to be back with you guys, and we're actually can see each other on screen, which is quite nice to be talking to someone and be able to see them.
Yeah, and you did just show us the view outside of your office. Perhaps, yeah, you know, tilt the screen and we'll enjoy the beautiful Wellington day you seem to be enjoying. Now, usually our episodes, we kick off with an introduction to the guest speaker. As Emma said, go back to season one, episode 12. We're going to dive straight in. We did also have some proposed talking points, but then the IPCC report has just come out, and we feel that would be the appropriate starting point for our conversation today. Where do we start? Mike, you've obviously had a good look at it. What's your initial thoughts? What's your initial reaction to the report?
Oh, I mean, I think, I assume that's the same for most people. We pretty much knew before it came out that it was going to be bad news, that things are happening faster than had been predicted, and basically that we're not doing anything. The world's not doing anything. New Zealand's certainly not doing anything. I saw a report the other day ranking us on actual, commitments and what we've achieved, and we were in amongst the worst. Well, we scored zero out of a possible five for actions. And so, yeah, we're leading.
We're right up down there with you.
yeah, we were there with the worst in the world. As much as, although I thought it was an award or a metric for talking about climate change, I'm sure we'd win that. I'm sure that we do a lot of talking. At least government does a lot of talking about it, but we don't do much change. Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, it's shocking, but the reality is there's like this huge elephant in the room, and that is the connection between GDP and greenhouse gas emissions. They are lockstep, locked together. And if we are going to get out of this climate nightmare, which, to remind people, is just a symptom of a whole bunch of crises that are coming at us because of the way we live and the way we exploit the planet, then we have to... We can't have a high GDP, we can't have economic growth and a declining greenhouse gas emissions. And we have to face that reality. And that is the thing that governments will not want to be part of, because they'll be voted out tomorrow if they were honest about that kind of thing. So this is a dilemma for all of us, is trying to imagine a world where economic growth was missing and we actually started to degrow. Our only future is degrowth, and that's a really tough sell. It shouldn't be, you know, we should have taken that lesson from COVID, that during the lockdown, you know, for many, many people in the kind of affluent world where we're doing most of the harm, it was amazingly good. And we talked about that before, about how, you know, the classic line is, I'm going on holiday to get away from it all. And you know, why don't we change it so we don't have to get away from it? Why don't we reduce the crazy life that we live in? And that's kind of what's buried in that climate change report is if we don't do that, really bad stuff's coming. Really bad stuff is already starting to happen, but it's going to get a whole lot worse unless we change.
So I maybe want to follow that train of thought then, and we'll kind of circle back and weave in the IPCC report as we go. But I think all three of us here are in agreement that continued economic growth and betting on, you know, these speculative technologies in order to meet the necessary climate targets, probably not going to work. And we have an unprecedented level of consumption right now. There's no way we can sustain infinite growth on a planet with finite resources, right? And I know that you've written brilliantly on this topic a number of times, especially your Green Growth article for The Conversation. Could you expand on, you know, our growth mentality at the moment and, you know, the need for an alternative if we're actually ever going to make headway on this?
Yeah, I mean, this is a great example out of this report, is that we don't have the time left now to do. So you know, the government's response is, well, all they seem to have done is to make electric vehicles cheaper, right? Now, that's a really good example of something that's not going to get us anywhere. It's not going to solve any problems. You're going to build a whole lot of electric vehicles, import a whole lot of electric vehicles with embodied, embedded emissions in them. And at some point in their life, they will be less harmful than the petrol cars that we're driving around in the moment, some many years ahead. We don't have time for that now. So by the time they start being better, this less harm thing is something we all have to think about too. So instead of punching you in the nose, I'm going to slap you around the head. That's just sort of, that's less harmful. That's an EV versus a petrol car. It's still harmful. We have to think about how we can't have cars as the predominant mode of transport anymore. So, and the same with all the wind turbines and all of the things that people have in mind, and the huge batteries and the mining and the harm we'll have to do to produce them. They all have massive, massive greenhouse gas footprints to construct and to get them in place. Then arguably at some point in time in the future, we'll be better off with them. But by the time that happens, we've already used up. We've got 400 gigatons, I saw, to keep us under 2 degrees. We can use 400 gigatons, which at today's rate's about 8 years worth of consumption. So even if we just carried on at today's consumption, not let alone, you know, all of the building of all these other infrastructures, you know, like cycle lane across the harbour. I mean, just crazy amounts of concrete that would go into that, or steel or whatever, to build that, to put some bikes across there, versus shut one lane for cars and put the bikes across the lane. You would have the double advantage of getting bikes across there, but getting less cars across there, making you want to make the traffic jam as big as possible for this. And this is what no one's going to be, who, you know, what council is going to come up with that, or what politician is going to say that. But that's the only way that we're going to improve things, is by saying, no, we can't. We have to have less. We have to make a traffic jam, because otherwise people will keep driving. You know, it's tricky. And this carbon zero thing, you know, I just been working with a group with Wellington City Council on becoming carbon zero or net zero, and a whole lot of companies have done this, and it's such a scam. And luckily, I mean, I think it's great that there's a lot more writing about that. I think businesses have got away with it for a while now, doing just about everything I pick up's got a carbon zero sticker on it, and now people are showing just what a sham and a scam that is. So for example, for Wellington City Council, you draw a boundary. Of course, the city boundary is the boundary, and you only count the emissions that are produced within that boundary. You don't count any of the embodied emissions that come into it. And we do this as countries as well, but this is a really good example just to get it across to people. So the biggest greenhouse gas footprint for Wellington was transport, and that's the fuel that's being sold in the city. So here's a really cool solution. Just shift every service station just outside the boundary, right? Take all the service stations out of Wellington and put them just So for Wellington, it'll be just along the motorway and put them in the Hutt Valley and on the motorway or in Poirua. So Poirua City and Hutt City then have those emissions. Then you've completely solved your problem and you've got carbon neutral Wellington, you know. And that's the kind of scam, idiotic, kid ourselves things that we do at the moment. And businesses are playing on this and they're playing a really short-term, stupid game with it. And we have to call it out. And luckily, it is being called out more and more. And so, you know, this is another hurdle in this. You know, what do we need to do to have a livable future? Well, one of them is to kind of find our way through this maze of spin and little scams like climate neutral, carbon neutral, carbon zero. You know, we actually have to stop emitting carbon, not playing games with it. I don't know if I'm jumping ahead here, but if we thought about embodied emissions, so everything that we bought, you don't load the emissions on the, like my laptop here that, I don't know, it was made in China, I think. At the moment, we kid ourselves that we have lower emissions, and China has higher because the emissions for building that thing go on China. But I'm consuming it. It's the same as that meme that I keep seeing. And I don't know the exact numbers. It says something like, you know, we need to make individual change, but 70 companies are responsible for nearly all of the greenhouse gas emissions. Okay, that's fine, but they wouldn't exist if we didn't buy shit off them. And that's why there's no good blaming the oil company and then driving around in cars and buses and aeroplanes that, you know, because you're supporting them. You can't pretend that because they're a company that's all their emissions. They're our emissions because we use the stuff. So, you know, that kind of reality, trying to get that reality across to people, I guess, is the challenge for us. It's, you know, trying to communicate the science is having people understand that something isn't magically carbon zero. And if we put those emissions on, the laptop had the emissions tied to it rather than to the country, and you had to pay that, you know, that would be a way. And then the electric vehicle might suddenly become $200,000, but the petrol vehicle would be as well, because you're paying the true costs of it rather than loading it onto another country. And that would be a way, I think, of seeing some real change. So that cell phones, everything, and it's going to be hard because, but then again, it would possibly be more just because it's the really expensive top end items that people are buying that are mostly toys and things that you would pay those costs on. And as long as, you know, the costs wouldn't be loaded then onto local food, and you know, you could, your dietary choices could reflect the costs, and so then you could make, you know, the cheaper items would be the ones that have the smaller footprints, because you would put the true cost onto the luxury ones, the imported oranges from wherever they come from and all the things that we see in the supermarket. If they had their emissions loading onto them at source, not given to the country but added to the product itself, then I think that we'd be much more accurate. It's, you know, it's like the tourism thing where we ignore the emissions of the plane because it's flying between countries. We only count what's within our country. And the other shocker around that, this, you know, the way we kid ourselves around emissions measuring, and I think this came out in some of the commentary around the latest IPCC report, is that military emissions are not counted. It's like we pretend and I think the military emissions are equivalent to 100-odd countries, you know, so... Mm. You know, all of that stuff where we're deluding ourselves, if we could just, you know, wipe out a bit of that stuff, have some real truth telling around that, and we'd be more likely, yeah, to do the right thing.
I've noticed that Scott Morrison, I mean, Australia's an embarrassment on the world stage when it comes to climate action, but he's been very deliberate since this report has come out. Mm. He's carefully trying to twist the narrative there. I think he's really trying to tap into the racist undercurrents in Australia, but deflecting the blame onto developing nations. He singled out China as well. It's like, we're the ones that are driving demand for the products that are getting made there. Like,
that's right. Yeah, their per capita emissions are really low if you don't, for what they consume. It's what they're making for us. And it's just us shifting our emissions offshore so that we can make it look better for us. And so, and I'm sure there's going to be more of that kind of, you know, game playing by politicians and blame it on somebody else.
Although the same, I mean, you know, we talk about China exporting a lot of it, but they also import a lot. And that links back to New Zealand with dairy. It links back with soy production. That's, you know, that's one of the big drivers for the destruction of the Amazon forest. So really, you know, all these big nations, I don't know if anyone stands out innocent. If anything, it's probably the developing world, the island nations and so on that are really suffering the most. But, you know, it really comes down to the change of status quo. That's really what it is. I mean, it's we've created a society that it's cool to buy the latest thing. It's cool to have the latest fashion, the upgraded toy, and so on, and that
the SUV.
It's and Mike, you talk about, you know, the production of a lot of these items, and if we use EVs, electric vehicles, as an example, you know, the mining, the associated welfare of child welfare and also all these other elements that come into the production. But there's also at the end of the life cycle of these products, that's another issue that we don't realize. They've actually got lifespans, limited lifespans. A battery, we know this from our iPhones. It doesn't hold the charge anymore after 2 years. Batteries are going to be the same thing in vehicles. What do we do with those? Any country that does recycle, it's kids that recycle these things, and it's hugely expensive. It's toxic. And you know, for our listeners, just digress very quickly again. If you go and have a look at our recommended reading list, and we've got no association to these books, but they're books that we've read, Bright Green Lies and Less is More. These are two books that will really, really blow your mind. Because it'll, yes, EVs trump a petrol vehicle because there's very little emission. And that's what people are so focused on. Yeah, but it's low emitting, if anything. But it's everything around that could actually make the vehicle worse than a combustion vehicle. So really, it's about changing our mindset. And how do we do that if it's so ingrained for centuries, this mindset?
Yeah, that's the big dilemma, isn't it? We've known is growth. You know, there's actually a couple of good papers that I'll pass on links to that been really taken me in the last few weeks. In both cases, William Rees is the author or co-author on these papers, and you know, he makes the point about humans have been on this around for 300,000 years, and it's just this last couple of hundred, you know, so a tiny, you know, almost immeasurably small part of human existence has been in this industrial, crazy, you know, consumption-driven, growth-driven paradigm. And it's clearly, clearly unsustainable, and it clearly got us into a lot of trouble. When you think about it that way, I think it makes it easier to think about how we existed for a long time without any of this stuff that we seem to think we can't do without now. And so, you know, that's, I think it makes me, it certainly makes me feel better about how we need to be in the future, that we've shown that we can do it. We've been around a lot longer without it than we have with it. So, you know, it is doable.
So let's, referring back to the IPCC report, you know, how does this impact us in Australia and New Zealand? Well, there's a regional fact sheet that highlights how it directly impacts us in this part of the world. And a lot is around heat extremes being increased, cold extremes decreasing, relative sea level rising, reduced snow cover and depth, I'm scanning down this list: enhanced warming, sandstorms and dust storms, in particular for New Zealand, projected increase in winter spring rainfall, so intensity and frequency, but less rain up north, so more drought. How does this impact food production, impacts direct health in terms of respiratory and mental health and so on? It affects biodiversity. These are topics that we cover a lot. This is impacted directly by the climate change, increase in global warming, and it's happening right here. And we see this a lot in New Zealand. And let's now talk a little bit about our waterways, because that's something that you're very passionate about, Mike, and it's something that you talk a lot about. Where are we at with that? I mean, we do fantastic with rankings in terms of some of our rivers. We've got some of the worst stats in terms of biodiversity loss, etc. Give us a brief synopsis on our waterways.
I think the simplest thing is that we're getting worse. I was just being down at the Environmental Defence Society conference in Christchurch last week, and I presented a paper, you know, just trying to highlight the scale of change. But one of the graphs from a paper we've just published showing nitrate levels or flux of nitrogen through our rivers in a global comparison. And there's only a couple of rivers in the world that are worse than our rivers. First, the highest on our list was Selwyn River in Christchurch in Canterbury. And then Manawatu River and the Waikato River. So the Yangtze and we, you know, some of our rivers are worse than the Mississippi River. You know, so global comparisons, we're really bad. And it's mostly about, you know, nutrient levels. We've had, you know, where harm to our freshwaters kind of happened in stages. Clearing of forests was really hard on them. We've done a whole lot of physical harm to them by putting our cities on the edges of them and then squeezing them into narrow places where they didn't want to go. We build cities on top of river plains and then wonder why they flood. You know, the Waikato is pretty much built on a huge swamp wetland, and we spend mega, mega amounts of energy pumping the water out of that so we can farm those areas. But yeah, high nutrients are the thing that I've been concentrating on, because we've had a 1,361% increase in the use of urea nitrogen fertilizer since 1990 on our land. And that's to grow cows or grow grass to feed cows. And we've had a massive increase in there, particularly in Canterbury. It's gone from, you know, virtually none to 1.3 million cows there now. And they're all urinating that nitrogen back into groundwater. So we've got health issues now. We've got the specter of the link between nitrate and drinking water and colorectal cancer and preterm births and thyroid cancers and things like that. And so the latest study that I've been working on, and we hopefully get published soon, it's under review at the moment, is looking at showing that 800,000 New Zealanders receive drinking water with nitrate levels higher than what is shown to be give you an increased risk of colorectal cancer, based on a whole bunch of studies around the world.
That's what, about 20% of our population, something like
that? Yeah, well, I mean, no, we only had data for 4 million. So there's 5 million New Zealanders, but there's 4 million on registered water supplies. So we only had those on registered water supplies. So 800,000 of the 4 million exceed that 0.87 milligrams nitrate. And the natural levels, which is what we were going to touch on, I guess, with that, you know, with the Stats New Zealand thing, we can talk about, you know, how much of an increase that is over the natural nitrate levels in freshwater in New Zealand. And it's very, very similar to the greenhouse gas emission stuff, where, you know, 100-odd years ago, we discovered how we could make nitrogen fertilizer out of fossil fuels. And the Haber-Bosch process, and so this is, you know, hailed as this fantastic thing because we could feed so many more people, and it led to the Green Revolution and a massive, massive increase in the number of human beings on the planet because we could feed so many more of them. And it seemed like a fantastic idea, but of course, like all of these ideas, suddenly there's a realization down the road that you've altered the natural nitrogen cycle to the such an extent that we now produce more artificially than natural. And then we discover, well, surprise, surprise, these unnatural levels have consequences, human health consequences, you know. And in the same way, we can measure nitrogen increases in the atmosphere, nitrous oxide in parts per billion going up at a similar rate to carbon dioxide increases. And we can measure the nitrate in our waters and the effects on human health for drinking water, but the ecosystem level effects, the effects on the oceans. It was an amazing clip. Jeff Reed has been down in the South Island, and he showed a clip of Lake Te Waihoro, or Lake Ellesmere, as some people will know it, near Canterbury. The lake that's in, or estuary lake, that's in big trouble through excess nitrogen from intensive farming, with this bright green algal or bacterial bloom washed out into the ocean. And with his drone, he managed, so you see this crazy bright green, almost iridescent green color hitting the ocean and the big plume going out into the ocean. And then amongst all that plume feeding on the fish and things that are being washed in and out of that lake were Hector's dolphins and New Zealand fur seals. And so there's warnings all around that lake about don't touch in this, don't drink it, don't swim in it, because it's harmful to human health. Well, there's these other mammals that are out there, you know, feeding in this stuff, the potential risk for them. I don't know that if anyone's quantified it. It's all new. No one's ever really thought about it, I don't think, until Jeff showed this footage. But, you know, if we start killing off Hector's dolphins, not just through fishing, but also through our polluted water going out there, then we're, you know, it's just going to be another hit for our biodiversity loss. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm kind of going all over the show here, but yeah, our water is really bad and getting worse because primarily of a over intensified industrial agriculture system where we take fossil fuels and we grow grass to make milk, and that milk then is dried using coal. So 95% of it's exported, only 5% of it stays here, about 1 or 2% gets drunk as milk, the rest gets exported. Most of that gets dried using coal and is then becomes either breast milk replacement or junk food filler. So all of these claims about feeding the world would be true, feeding 40 million people or whatever the stats are, 20 million, I think, for the dairy products. But how do you, so having some people in the rest of the world eating Moro bars and Oreo bar biscuits and things like that, is that feeding them, you know, or is that making them sick? And so we have to, it's such a easy claim, but I'd like to see it quantified in some way.
That's the thing. The Haber-Bosch process to me seems to have benefited the ultra processed food industry and the feeding for more animals. You know, how much have we directly benefited the actual health of human beings? Mm. And that's the irony in this.
Yeah. And that's the kind of thing we should be measuring, shouldn't we? You know, not some kind of gross thing and we make so many tons of this stuff, but where does it end up? What's it being consumed as? Is it actually, so at some point, hopefully in the future, we're going to have a rational argument, a discussion around, you know, how much longer do we keep destroying New Zealand to bring in some money, but that the product we're producing is harmful. So, you know, and it's not feeding the world, and we're going to have reality biting on food shortages, and we already are. There's already huge numbers of people die or are sick through lack of nutrition, you know, whereas what we make just makes rich people sicker, so as I can tell. So, you know, that's the kind of analysis we need to have that's sorely missing.
Now, Mike, you've for years been calling out agencies using dodgy water statistics. So you mentioned the Stats New Zealand saga before. You've had a bit of a win recently regarding that website. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what that was all about?
Oh, it seems so bizarre that for years, no, literally maybe 5 years at least, I've been going on about this claim on the Ministry for the Environment's website under nitrate and groundwater. They have this 3 milligrams per litre nitrate nitrogen as the natural level. And then in brackets with the citations, there's two papers that are cited there, one from 2012, one from 2005. But if you go to those two papers, they don't say 3 milligrams is natural. They say the opposite. They say that natural, well, they did some work on old groundwater pre-1800s, and it was virtually undetectable nitrogen in that old water. They can use isotopes to age the water, and so they know that. And actually what it says is if it gets up to 3 milligrams, that is proof that it's polluted. And so that someone has, and I don't want to, you know, kind of guess about where that came from, but this is a classic case of somebody says it and puts these two citations, and then nobody actually goes and looks at the citations. They just repeat the statement. So six of the regional councils, and there may be more, but we found six regional councils that have this statement copied word for word from Ministry for the Environment and Stats New Zealand, because they've combined now on their environmental reporting. And so it was both them. So then I've been banging on about this for years and years and years, and then suddenly an email comes out, and it wasn't to me. It wasn't addressed to me. It was addressed to a big list. You know, they were blind BCC'd, so I couldn't see who else was on it, saying Stats New Zealand, I haven't got it in front of me, but basically we've decided that the 3 milligrams is not correct, and so we will not be reporting that. And so they take it off, they admit that they're wrong, they take it off the website, but then they go, what they do is then is throw the baby out with the bathwater, and there is no natural level now. They don't, so people can't, so there's some stats around nitrate and groundwater and some trends about what's getting worse and what's not, but nothing for people to compare it with. So you don't know what is the normal level. They're required under the Act, under the Reporting Act, and I'm in the middle of email conversations with them at the moment about that. They've actually dropped what was their, you know, they're not fulfilling their role to inform the public of New Zealand what has happened to groundwater, because if people don't know what the natural level was, then they can't say, they can't possibly hope to know what bad is. And so it's kind of it's a win, but a pretty hollow win when they throw the whole thing out.
And, hidden agenda behind this? I mean, you know, initially you could say an honest mistake, someone, you know, just got things muddled up. But if for years they've been hassled about, look, recheck, it's not right. And now this, you know, they're not replacing, they're not amending, they're just removing.
I mean, this wasn't the first one. This is the second win, if you call it a win. And I was interviewed on Radio New Zealand by Catherine Ryan, and you know, it was a reminder that 4 years previously I'd been on her morning show on Radio New Zealand talking about how calling out Ministry for the Environment for fake claims around water quality, and where that I'll say mistakenly, but that. They'd confused what was something statistically significant or not, and to the claim that because it wasn't statistically significant, therefore it was stable, which is not correct at all. It just didn't meet a requirement. And by reducing the time period, you can make the significance of a trend go away. I mean, any statisticians listening to this will know what I'm talking about. It's a type one error, but it's, you know, So the cover up was, look, I always think with these things, and I don't know if this is kind of rude, but you have this, is it a cock up or a conspiracy, right? That's always the dilemma. Is it a mistake or is it a conspiracy? Well, if it was a mistake, you know, it was just a random, then randomly it would go in both directions. You'd have sometimes saying the problem's worse than it is, and sometimes saying the problem's better than what it is. But I can give 10 examples of where they incorrectly report, but it's always in one direction. It's always claiming to be better than what it actually is. So to me, that that takes the cock up bit out of the argument and it becomes conspiracy. And that's not a, you know, not like a crazy conspiracy. It's just the reality of having regional councils reporting on themselves and gathering the data that so that self-reporting on their own ability to protect the environment, and then passing that on to a ministry who's also self-reporting. And so they are supposed to be protecting the environment. So they, you know, how there's always a tendency if you.
But they're just self-protecting their own interests. I mean, that's
the right. End of that, yeah. I mean, like I say, if my students, instead of having an exam at the end of the year, I could just get them to write, tell me, you know, how well they did. And we could save the whole process. I wouldn't have any exams to mark because they would all get A's because they all would have done a fantastic job. So,
yeah. So we're throwing numbers around. We're throwing, you know, there's a lot of figures and. Mm-hmm. I guess there's a two-part. What is your ideal, not the compromised number, but in your ideal world, what's, or maybe not ideal, with the science backs, what's the correct threshold for nitrates in water in terms of anything above starts becoming a problem? Because I've also seen that a national policy statement, I'm wondering how the hell did we go from 0.44 milligrams to 6.9? How did that happen?
Yeah, that's another one of those same things. And that happened under the national government, and that was clearly to allow more intensification. So the 0.44 comes from 20-year-old science, and it was a collaboration between Australia and New Zealand, and we set these limits. And it's based on not much data, but it's since been supported. I mean, I've just, again, we can put a link to these papers in, right? But Adam Canning and myself and Russell Death wrote, published a paper just the other day showing that the amount of out of 1500 sites, when you look at the MCI, which is the macroinvertebrate community index, so a measure of the ecosystem health of a stream, tips suddenly once you get above 0.67 milligrams. So the 0.44 is a safe level, but then when you get to, if it's below 0.44, then you don't have problems. Get above that, you start to see problems. 0.67 was the main inflection where suddenly it went downhill in a big hurry after 0.67. The Manawatu River at Hopelands Road, the median there is 0.64 milligrams, and we can see oxygen fluctuations at that site that have been well written up and over about 10 years now. Extreme oxygen fluctuations, which is the thing that we're worried about with nitrogen, not forgetting human health and drinking water, but just from an ecosystem point of view, it's not the nitrogen itself, it's what the nitrogen does. So you put nitrogen on your paddock to grow grass, you get nitrogen in rivers, it grows algae, which is the, you know, riverine version of grass. And that's okay, that would be, it's unsightly, it's slippery, it's ugly, but what it does is it, being a plant photosynthesizing, it sucks the water out, the oxygen out during the night and pumps it out during the day. So in a healthy river, oxygen really doesn't change through a 24-hour period. In an unhealthy river, i.e. one that's got lots of nutrient, which grows lots of algae, it starts to do these massive swings. And once the swings start, then your fish and invertebrates don't have any oxygen to live on. I mean, for your listeners, if you've seen goldfish in a bowl gulping, you know, if you don't have an aerator in there, they gulp air off the surface. They'll probably do it most, especially if you've got some plants in the tank. They have the ability to suck some air out of the atmosphere. Most of our, or pretty much all of our native fish don't have that ability to do that. So they'll die, and most of the invertebrates will die through lack of oxygen. Okay, that's right down at 0.6. Around that level, definitely less than 1 milligram, you start having all these negative effects. What the 6.9 that the Minister Smith came up with back in 2014, that is the toxic level of nitrogen. So at a later point, and I think the best analogy for your listeners would be, we know that alcohol, high levels of alcohol in the bloodstream will kill humans, right? But we know at much lower levels than that, we become dangerous. We crash cars and all that kind of thing. It will kill us eventually. And so think about the same thing with nitrogen. the effects are bad at very low levels under one. Once you get above 1 milligram, you start having these secondary effects that will kill the fish or the invertebrates. They can't die again at 6.9 milligrams, which is where the nitrogen becomes toxic. So it was a classic misuse of science by politicians. So they asked, and I remember this question in Parliament, well, I keep replaying it in my head. Eugenie Sage asked Amy Adams, so why have you come up with the 6.9 milligrams? She said, well, we asked the scientists. But they asked the wrong question. They asked the scientists, what's the toxic level of nitrogen? And that's meaningless. It only works in a tank in a lab when you're testing this stuff. Out in the real world, when oxygen levels are low, temperatures are high, and you kill them, they can't die again later. And it's so that's kind of the long story. But the national policy statement that we have now, the Science Technical Advisory Group advised 1 milligram to be the limit. Minister Parker said no, he wanted 2.4 milligrams. He wanted to compromise there, which is, again, based on the toxicity, not on the ecosystem health level.
And even one is a compromise to some degree.
Yeah, even one. Yeah, I mean, we've shown that it should be back lower than that. The 0.44 that we had in the first place is where it should have been, you know. So, yeah, it's a game. It's, again, it's politics versus science, you know.
All linked back to GDP and linked back to
growth. Yeah, right, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you were to go off the 0.44, I don't know if you know these stats off the top of your head, but how... Mm. What percentage of your lakes and your waterways would be polluted?
Oh, again, we can put the link in the notes, but you can go to the Ministry for the Environment Stats New Zealand webpage, and there's some maps on there, and you can see what's above that 0.44, and it's pretty much all of lowland New Zealand.
It's 85%, isn't it? Farmed.
Oh, yeah, of lowland rivers, it's 85% of lowland rivers, yeah. So we're already well past it, you know. It's a bit like the old, you know, 4 parts per million, you know, carbon in the atmosphere, how, you know, natural was 290 or something, and then we kind of had 350 as the max we should go to, and then we just marched on past it as if it didn't even exist, you know.
And all that... you know, for only consumption, you know, 5% is what we're consuming. So we love our dairy, we're going to consume milk, cheese, and so on. I mean, imagine we only had 5% of the herd. I mean,
Well, that's it. I mean, we could get rid of 90. I mean, people have contacted me saying, oh, well, you're going to get rid of the cows, I won't have any cheese. And well, no, you can get rid of 95% of the cows and you'll still have your cheese and all that kind of thing. We could feed New Zealand on a tiny proportion of what we have, you know.
And look, and there's a lot of success stories and now papers coming out showing that reduced herd sizes are actually beneficial for the farmers themselves from a financial point of view, from a profitability point of view. So, you know, I mean, again, we don't need to go too deep down this path because we know where we're going to end up, but it's being driven by the bigger picture. And I think a lot of farmers are stuck in that system, the debt. The contracts, et cetera, and it's just, you know, how to get them out. But you've made some suggestions on that. You know, you've contested the whole notion of, okay, well, the government's going to put aside money to clean up the rivers. I mean, you know, the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff scenario. Whereas your suggestion is, and it's not just yours, but your suggestion is that, no, let's put the money towards stopping farmers from farming in particular areas that are contributing. You know, they're farming on pieces of land that they shouldn't be farming in the first place.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, and I mean, I'm just basing that on what we're already doing. So Lake Taupo and Lake Rotorua, we have paid and are paying farmers to get those cows off the land to protect those two lakes. We're paying $40 million to get 100 tonnes less nitrogen into Lake Rotorua, which is $400 for every kilogram leached. Okay, I don't know, you know, we could talk about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. For me, it's a good thing, although I would have never thought I'd say this, but it's the only thing that's worked, right? Of all of the other stuff, you know, all of these other limits that we talked about, they're virtual limits. We're talking about 1 milligram or 2.4 or 6.9. They're kind of meaningless because the councils aren't implementing them anyway, you know, and so that's another whole discussion we could have. But so if you just take what we are doing to protect those two lakes, which are very important to a lot of people in New Zealand, I get that. And I totally agree with that, that we should protect those two lakes. But why only those two lakes? Because if we apply the same logic to the rest of our waterways and go to Canterbury, for example, and we've got exact numbers for how much nitrogen is being leached from Canterbury from intensive dairy, and we work out that $400 a kilogram, then it comes to $12 billion. So what that means is we are subsidizing the harm that dairy does in Canterbury to the tune of $12 billion every year. That's the yearly loss of nitrogen from that system. So all my argument is, and it's a really simple one, is wouldn't it be better to pay $12 billion to stop the problem? That's a one-off, because every year we are having $12 billion worth of harm being done. I mean, that's pretty basic maths, isn't it? If you pay, something's happening and it's harming you, I don't know, somebody comes around every year and punches you in the head. If you pay them $1,000, they won't ever do it again. And you could say, well, that's, why are you paying someone to do harm? But, well, I'm just being rational here, and it's much cheaper to do it once and stop it. And we've kind of had that example now, haven't we, from COVID, that we can create money when we need to, when it's urgent. So if somebody wants to tell me that $12 billion is too much, well, yeah, I agree, it's a huge amount of money, but that's the harm that's being done. And the thing is that we're not paying that $12 billion harm at the moment. We're just letting it build up in the environment. It's just building up in the groundwater. And we showed and presented at this conference the other day that given the amount of rainfall you have in Canterbury and forgetting the fact that it's actually declining, at the amount that nitrate loss with that rainfall means that all of the groundwater in Canterbury will reach 10 or 11 milligrams. A lot of it's already happened, which is, 10 times higher than that cancer number is already. And so it'll just keep building up. And so we're just passing, we're having our fun now. So by allowing that to be passed on to future generations to have to deal with, either with through cancers or not drinking that water and having to find alternative water supplies, because it's very hard to get nitrate out of that water. So, why aren't we having these rational discussions? Why do we keep defending this with almost religious protection for an industry that doesn't deserve it? Because it's a bit like rugby. We just can't seem to, I talked on News Talk ZB, they interviewed me about this, and people are rabid about, anyone daring to question dairy. And it's not the farmers. It's not the farmers are the meat in the sandwich here. I'm not anti-farmers or anti-farming. It's the industrialization of the farming that's the problem and the harm that it does to everybody else.
So if you woke up tomorrow and...
If I wake up.
When you wake up tomorrow.
Well, hopefully I wake up tomorrow.
It's a hypothetical here. That's why I used the word if. Okay. I'm not wishing you any harm here.
No, that's good.
So, when you wake up tomorrow, and if you were Prime Minister, what would be the first thing that you'd want to take action on? What do we need to do here?
He'd be thanking all of us for voting him in.
Yeah.
And we'd be thanking him in return.
I would be not wanting to be in that position, but... I would just like us to be to have rational discussions about this. I mean, it's really changing. I don't know if you guys have seen the Milk and Money series that's on TV1 at the moment. It's on. You can get on demand, and the docos that are coming out and the reality around this. People are talking about it now. It's becoming much more real. So, I just want us to have a grown-up discussion about this stuff and not get locked into this kind of, well, it's good for the economy. I heard them on the radio this morning on national radio, telling the story that now because tourism's out because of COVID, then these export industries like dairy are keeping the economy alive. But it's such a narrow view because you're not measuring the costs. It's just I'm not an accountant, but if I had a business and I only talked about the profit, and if I was selling coffees and I didn't I only talked about how much money I made selling the coffees, not what the coffee machine and the coffee cost me, then of course it's going to look like the best business in the world. But that's why we've got to take our blinkers off and look at the costs. And if we do that, then it's very clear that we are doing the wrong thing here.
We measure the country's health by its GDP, not the health of the people. And this intensification of dairy farming is harming our health. It's harming the biodiversity's health, which in turn, again, harms our health. We're eradicating more forests in Australia, especially, again, impact on our health. Yeah. So that's when we talk about the change in narrative, it's we're measuring success and health from a complete wrong perspective, and then mental health issues and other climate change related health, you know, issues rise. Now, how do we fund that?
Yeah, I think that the Indigenous knowledge is so clear around this that, that healthy people, healthy and healthy river, you know, I am the river is me, that it's, you know, it's so core and so fundamental that you can't have healthy people if you don't have a healthy environment. And so the more we make the environment unhealthy, the unhealthier we're going to be. You know, it's so, so simple and clear. We've just got lost in this, you know, high-tech fake world that we live in.
And we view ourselves as separate.
Yes. Yeah.
Not part of the environment. Yeah. We're separate. Yeah. We're above that.
Yeah. Yeah. We're special. That's the other Derek Jensen book that I'm reading is Human Supremacy. And it makes you think about that we, you know, I've heard of, you know, we talk about white supremacists and that kind of thing, but we are human supremacists because we seem to think that we're above everything else. And so we can control everything else. And that is a really, really dangerous place that we've got ourselves into.
Now, you recently wrote, I don't know, when I say recently, it's all relative, but you wrote an essay titled Food for Healing that is in the new Possible Essay book, which is also on our recommended reading list.
Yeah.
And, you know, you pretty much cover a lot of what we've just spoken about. But your last paragraph, you say that you are hopeful. You know, it's very easy with these kind of discussions to feel very helpless and very depressed because it's the government, it's policy, it's businesses and so on. But you say, quote, our current predicament does not depress me. And this was reinforced by the COVID-19 response because I know that the changes we must make to survive will be positive. So there is hope.
It's when we get there, it's just how we get there, you know, and I don't want us to leave it until we don't have an option and we just crash. I want us to manage our way out of it.
Which kind of feels like we are heading that way. You know, it is panic stations at the moment, but there, you know, we can, I mean, there's quite a few campaigns out there at the moment that are calling for helping and upskilling and providing the tools for farmers to transition to more regenerative ways of farming. So there are, you know, we do care, and farmers sometimes do get targeted unfairly in some respect, and you know, farmers are crucial, whether it is dairy farming or crops. I mean, we need farmers to some degree. So there are campaigns to help them, to provide the assistance to transition. And I think that's one positive thing as well. So we can't wait till it's too late, although it does feel kind of like that with some of our waterways. You know, have we reached a tipping point with our waterways? Do you see some of those recovering?
No, we're way past the tipping point there. But, you know, for that example, those farmers that have been paid not to farm in those places, and when you go and talk to them, they're so much happier with their, you know, the changes that they've made and getting those big intensified animals off the land, and life becomes, you know, so much better for them, for the animals, for the waterways. You know, it's a trap that we've all got into, farmers and us, of this highly technical, sped up, crazy, you know, world that we live in, that we don't know any different because we look around and that's normal. We only get a glimpse of how it could be, you know, like in COVID lockdown, and I don't think the farmers got that opportunity, but the farmers that I know on farms that have really cut back and they've gone onto once a day milking and they've reduced intensity and they've grown a lot more bush and getting into other land uses, they are so happy and so excited about the changes and how much better life can be. It's that, and that goes for individuals, just somehow getting that first push. And for farmers where that right to pollute has been capitalized into the land value, then it's a hard road or almost impossible to get out of unless you give that assistance. So that's where buying those polluting rights, a failure of 30 years of government to regulate, which ended up in the right to pollute. We've got to buy it back again. It wasn't their fault. They got caught up in it. We have to face the failure of government and get it back onto a level playing field again. Because the alternatives, you know, the guys that are doing the, when I always say guys, I mean, you know, that they're doing the right thing does cost money, you know, and so that we have to help with that.
And okay, so on that, let's talk about some positive kind of actions you're taking, because that's, as we learned a couple of episodes ago, a good way to deal with climate grief and eco-anxiety. So you're very active, you know, trying to cultivate some meaningful change here. You serve on the advisory board of the Environmental Law Initiative. That's a relatively new organisation in New Zealand. Can you give us a bit of an overview of their work and what they're trying to achieve?
Well, they're just starting out, but they're going to use the law. And I have to say that the only time I've seen wins is legal proceedings, you know, because it's sort of, it's almost like you have to force councils and force regulators to do their job. And so this is really cool. Some money put into a whole bunch of people around New Zealand working together on what seemingly small issues, but you know, they all add up and they do make a difference. If you win in one place here, then councils can see that they could potentially be sued if they don't get on with this or sort this out. So it can lead a lot of little wins lead to big wins, and so it's a good thing to be involved in.
And also some of these successes with small communities can be used as pathfinder projects, which help use as examples to accelerate changes with bigger entities where it really needs to happen. So that's an amazing initiative. And again, we'll put the links in our show notes and so on. But, you know, following on the social media account, Instagram and Facebook, there's a lot of activity, a lot of inside articles being shared. So again, if this interests our listeners, we encourage you to follow Environmental Law Initiative and support them in a way that you can. And there's another entity, Boomers for Real Climate Measures. A little bit of a different angle with this one. What's that one about?
This is about getting communicating the science or communicating the reality of the changes that we need. So this is a little group that I'm involved in. I've set up this charitable trust to get money to fund people to write articles in the mainstream media or get it out as much as possible, you know, for the spin-off or newsroom or The Conversation or, you know, those sort of places. So a grant to people to write these articles, and so people can donate to this Boomers Fund, just to try and crank up the balance a bit, because we tend to not talk about this issue enough. Business gets its way, so it's about trying to get more communication about the climate issues out there.
Now, the Boomers Fund is not a retirement policy. It's a real entity. But we do often make reference in terms of how can people take action. And I know Emma says this a lot, you know, write to your council, write to policymakers. Well, this is an opportunity perhaps for some of our listeners who have good writing skills. Maybe this is something they'd like to get involved in.
And I think it's asking the really important question too, like what legacy are we going to leave our children and our grandchildren? This is quite serious now. And like, I know the IPCC report, it needs to be that rallying cry that makes us get serious. I mean, we've already talked about that there's no surprises in that report because it's just a review of the evidence we already knew about. But what it makes really clear is that our time frame for action is so short now. So we are at the point where it is almost too late, but it's not yet. So
not quite,
We need a firecracker up our butt.
I think one of the big outcomes was that it's accelerating quicker.
Yeah, you know, than we were expecting.
And so, you know, that time frame, we've got 20 years, we've got 30. Mm-hmm. No, it's actually been shortened. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the real, kick that we need. It's we've known this, but we just didn't realize how urgent it's, even more urgent. It's always been urgent, but how more urgent it's become. So, yeah, there's a lot to digest. There's a lot of information we don't know. I mean, the more I learn, the more I feel I don't know. It's just this incredible journey. It's how much we're just so focused on, like I've said earlier, the status quo, the way we want to live, and we're too scared to change that for ourselves. We are in effect being selfish in some respect, you know. Mm. We get accustomed to a certain way of life, and changing that is just, but it's not fair. It's not nice, and that's not true. The change, it doesn't mean we have to go back to living in a cave. We can still live a very fulfilling, a very healthy, a good life, but we just have to do it by changing our addiction to consumption. We need to learn to reduce. And there's a lot of facets around there. Here, around that, we can be here for another 5 hours. But I think our listeners are starting to get the gist of what we're trying to head with.
I think so. Yeah.
Mike, it's been an absolute delight to have you back on. We know you are a supporter of what we do. I was going to say of our show, but we've become a little bit more than that ourselves now. Yep. Because, you know, after a year or so of the podcast, we got to a point ourselves where we talk a lot about the issues and what we can and should do. And we're now in a phase where we're going to start taking action ourselves. And that is by educating communities and advocating for that change. We don't know it all, but we certainly know a little bit, which is enough to at least initiate that and collaborating with other entities as well as along the way. So, you know, we really, thank you for your support. And your support is also by way of recommending books to read and papers you do for to us. It is appreciated. It really is. The feedbacks is we really, you know, it's something we're very appreciative of. So thank you for that. And thank you again for coming and sharing your knowledge and hopefully giving our listeners it's the reality check we always need. And that's something we can always trust on you to do that. Yep. So thank you very much, Mike.
No worries. It was really nice to talk to you guys. See ya.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. Make sure you subscribe and share this podcast with your friends and visit the website for more details.